KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me on the inaugural show for this fall quarter, and I hope that you're excited for the schedule coming up because it is a great one. I'm excited to start off our quarter with Professor Sharon Sandine from Hamline University School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota, where she is joining us via Skype to discuss trade secrecy, and particularly a piece that she's working on called Lost in the Cloud, the Trade Secret Implications of Cloud Computing. Trade secrecy is an area of law that I, in my full-time job as a professor at Elon University, focus on. It's an area that I write on extensively, focusing primarily on the impact of trade secrecy on public transparency issues. But it's not an area of law that we have spent much time with on Hearsay Culture, and so I'm excited to have that discussion with one of the leading scholars in trade secrecy in the country, Sharon Sandine. Sharon has written a number of articles on trade secrecy and other areas, and this piece delves into the intersection of trade secrecy with cloud computing, with the newest form of commercial computing, which is literally the storage of data in the clouds, in the vast ether. And there are a lot of implications of cloud computing, not only for trade secrecy, but for intellectual property law generally, and then beyond intellectual property, issues of privacy and so forth. And many of these issues do come up in the context of what we do with trade secrecy with computers and with cloud computing in particular. We're going to have a broad discussion initially of what a trade secret is, but as you think about these issues and as we discuss them, note generally that a trade secret is valuable primarily because it is not known by competitors. And that very basic part of our standard of what is a trade secret is implicated by the issues raised with cloud computing and what you can and cannot control in terms of security in the cloud. And there are a lot of other issues as well, but we're going to touch on those and discuss them today with Sharon. Again, Sharon is a professor at Hamline University School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota, and is joining us via Skype. So without further introduction, Sharon, thanks for taking the time to join us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you. I'm very excited to participate.
So, Sharon, let's start off with a question that I ask all of my authors and people that focus in these areas. Tell us a bit more about your background and how you became interested in trade secrecy and this topic.
I got interested in trade secrecy when I was practicing law. I started practicing law, believe it or not, 25 years ago, and did general business litigation, which involved several trade secret cases. And then about 10 years ago, when I decided to shift from practicing law to teaching, I surveyed the landscape of scholarship and thought that this was an area that needed more attention. And so that's why I've focused my writing in that area for the last 8 years.
You mentioned that it needed more attention. Can you be more specific? What kind of attention was lacking?
Well, there are treatises written on the subject, very good treatises. Probably the most well known one is by Roger Milgram, who I think first published it in 1964. There's another treatise by James Pooley that's more recent. But most of the scholarship in the trade secret area tends to be by practicing lawyers and tends to focus on, you know, what the law is, what happened in a particular case, and so forth and so on. And, you know, definitely the benefit of looking at these issues from a more scholarly point of view is to, you know, is to ask questions like, did the courts get it right? Is there another way we might look at it? Are there gaps in the law that we need to fill? That kind of thing.
The your practice experience is one that I think you certainly will delve into a little bit. But again, for purposes broadly of contextualizing where we are, perhaps we can start with a very, very basic question, which is, what is a trade secret? So how is it defined in the law?
Well, the predominant law governing trade secrets is called the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. It was first adopted 30 years ago, and it has been it was adopted by the National Conference of Commissioners of Uniform State Laws 30 years ago, but was enacted in states thereafter, and it's now been adopted by, you know, at least 45 of the 50 states. And according to that act, a trade secret has three requirements. First, it has to be secret, which is defined by the Uniform Trade Secret Act as meaning not generally known or readily ascertainable. Second, it has to have economic value due to its secrecy. And third, it has to be subject to reasonable efforts, or efforts that are reasonable under the circumstance, to protect the secrecy. Other than those three requirements, it can literally cover any information as long as those three requirements are met. So in that sense, it theoretically provides, it is the broadest form of intellectual property protection.
And that ties into my follow-up question, which is how generally trade secrecy relates to our other three forms of IP protection, copyright, patent, and trademark. I mean, again, I know that that's a question that we could spend several hours on, but as a general matter, how does trade secrecy intersect with those doctrines?
That's a great question, because it's subject to debate, and you can look at it from different points of view. You know, one point of view is to say that, you know, every patented invention starts as a trade secret. Somebody will work in their lab, come up with an idea, conduct R&D, reduce their idea to practice, and at that point they have a choice of protecting it as a trade secret or applying for a patent. But how trade secret is different from patents is that it's a state law doctrine. It arose out of common law, and it's mainly governed by state law. There are some federal laws, federal crimes, but it's a state law doctrine. So in that sense, it's more similar to trademark law. But the most important, I think, feature of trade secret law that makes it different from the other areas of IP is it arose out of principles of unfair competition. And although there's debate whether trade secrets are property or not, there's a big unfair competition component to any trade secret misappropriation claim. And by that I mean you have to prove in a trade secret infringement case or misappropriation case that the defendant did something wrong, whereas that's not necessarily the case in patent trademark and copyright.
And then, you know, and again, I think for especially for listeners who aren't familiar with trade secrecy, these basic underlying theories are important. You mentioned unfair competition, and so perhaps you could, again, recognizing that these are questions that we could take a lot of time on, generally what are, aside from unfair competition, what are the primary underlying theories driving trade secrecy?
Well, there's a debate about this, but I mean the main debate is whether you know, it's a form of property or a form of unfair competition. And what I argue is it's kind of a false debate, because the law defines what the elements of the cause of action are, and in truth, or in my opinion, there's elements of both embedded in the cause of action. You can't bring a successful trade secret misappropriation claim unless you prove that you own this thing which is a trade secret, a piece of information which meets the three requirements I mentioned earlier. But trespass of that thing, to use a property analogy, is not going to be enough to state a cause of action. You have to go further and show that either the information was, basically that the information was used in violation of a duty of confidentiality, or that it was improperly acquired.
And with regard to improperly acquired, I mean, what are we talking about there? What does that mean in practice?
It would be things like, burglary, bribery, electronic espionage, anything where you're engaging in usually some sort of, often some sort of criminal act in order to acquire the information. But it doesn't have to rise to the level of a crime.
So, we know that, and I think even if people have a very cursory understanding of trade secrecy or have heard of it, we know that the paradigm for a trade secret is the formula for Coca-Cola. And that's an example that newspapers will offer. With regard to more modern day examples of a trade secret, is there a prototypical trade secret that you would identify to contextualize the discussion we're going to have in a moment?
Well, I mean, there was a recent example of the recipe for Thomas's English muffins.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like often when an employee leaves a company that believes it has important secrets or recipes, that a trade secret claim will arise from that. So there's a lot of examples like that, but the key is figuring out whether or not the information is a trade secret.
Now,
I think one of the problems I should mention, one of the reasons I became interested in this area is I think a lot of times the cases are so motivated by the emotions of what's going on. At a gut level, people think, well, if a company has information and it's taken, that there's something wrong with that. But the truth is that our intellectual property laws are designed, at least theoretically, to encourage and facilitate the creation and free flow of information. And as a result, trade secret law has, limits placed on it. And so one of the reasons I got interested in writing in this area is to, make those limits clearer and to try to convince people, and particularly business people, that that if we have a trade secret system that protects too much information, that's not necessarily a good thing.
And that gets us, I think, more specifically into your paper. One last background question for purposes of understanding trade secrecy generally. So assuming that one can prove trade secret misappropriation, what remedies are offered? In other words, what can a trade secret holder get once that case is met?
Yeah, that's where trade secrecy and trade secret law and the other forms of IP have a lot in common. Typically in cases, there may not be any actual damages, particularly if you act quickly to stop what you perceive to be the wrong. There won't be any ability to actually prove that you've lost money. And so one of the principal remedies for trade secret violations is an injunction, which is all copyright, trademark, and patent. And because the thing about trade secrets is it's trade secret protection is weak on purpose. And the reason trade secret protection is weak on purpose is if it wasn't weak, it would conflict too greatly with patent and copyright law. and would be preempted. And so trade secret law is weak on purpose, and because of that, it's very easy to lose trade secret protection, and that's why the remedy of an injunction is so important. If you own a trade secret, you want to be able to go into court quickly and have an injunction issued so that you can hopefully preserve the secrecy of that information.
We're talking with Professor Sharon Sandeen of Hamline University School of Law and KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So Sharon, let's turn. I mean, there's more background we can get into, but I think we have enough to then turn to more specifically the focus of your article. And so let me ask you again this basic question. Hearsay Culture focuses on the intersection ultimately of IP and technology, although sometimes we cover more IP than technology and vice versa. Here we have a nice intersection, and I think many people in this audience will be familiar with what cloud computing is. But for those that aren't, what do you mean by cloud computing?
Well, as with all new, business models in high tech, what it actually means is going to be defined over time. You can define it broadly, and I think it has been defined by some people to include basically anything, any sort of service or business that's conducted on the internet. More narrowly, and the way I'm using it in my paper is to refer to the services that allow businesses and individuals to store information on remote servers operated by third parties.
So just and this gets into again more technology, but so what's the derivation of the use of the word cloud? I mean, what's the relevance of that term? What is it trying to connote?
Well, I think that. If you think of, that's a good question because there's a debate about who came up with this terminology. When I researched it, different companies had claimed to have invented that term, and different companies, in fact, had tried to trademark that term. Hmm. But I think what it's connoting is this, kind of place in the universe where you can store information. And so the reference to the cloud is this kind of amorphous, location for storage. And I think what's important about that imagery and what I think is an issue that we have to address regarding trade secret protection is that you don't know where the information is stored. It could be stored anywhere where the service provider has decided to place their servers. So
is now I think that gets us to a further question to understand where we're headed. Traditionally, how do companies protect their trade secrets? I mean, given the top of the paper, cloud computing being relatively new, that isn't the traditional method. To understand the differences that we're getting into, what are the traditional ways that businesses protect their trade secrets, or more specifically, store them?
Yes. Well, that's a good question. I think there's two types of businesses. There's the businesses that know they have trade secrets and consciously take action to protect them. And there are the businesses who don't really know they have trade secrets, but decide they have them after a valued employee leaves and they want to bring a lawsuit. I think that happens in a lot of situations because a lot of companies are not really aware of what they have and that it has the status or potentially may have the status of trade secrets. And it's only when an employee leaves or they're afraid somebody you know, misappropriated their trade secrets, that they find out from an attorney that they might have trade secret protection. Now, for the companies that are sophisticated, and I'm going to guess that, you know, most companies in Silicon Valley, for instance, are, and know that they have trade secrets, what they should do is they should identify the trade secrets and then engage in efforts to protect those trade secrets. Now, what efforts they should engage in will depend on what the secrets are and what they're doing with the secrets. But there's a lot of tools that you can use, just to name a few. You know, if the information is in hard copy form, you put it in a file cabinet and you lock the file cabinet. You limit access to who can open the file cabinet. If you have visitors visiting your plant and they can see what's going on the floor of your plant, then you might have them sign a confidentiality agreement. You might limit access to visitors to the plant. So there's a variety of things a business can do. It really depends on the nature of the information and how that information is being used.
We're chatting with Sharon Sandeen, professor of law at Hamline University School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. So businesses using the cloud to store trade secrets run into a variety of issues that you discuss in your article. In sum, before we get into it, what is at the core of the problem here? What are you concerned about?
Well, the core of the problem is transferring information to a third party. And this is something I've been interested in generally with regard to intellectual property, because when you really think about it, one of the reasons why we have intellectual property law is to control or the situation when information or data, whatever, invention, gets into a hands of a third party. If I have that type of information and want to give it to you, as an example, David, we could enter into a contract and I can restrict what you do. The problem is if it, for some reason, maybe you breach the contract or maybe somebody breaks into your offices and steals information or whatever. If it gets into the hands of a third party, that contractual control doesn't apply. And so a lot of IP law is about, in my opinion, dealing with that third party situation.
When you say it doesn't apply, Sharon, what do you mean specifically?
Well, let me give an example with respect to the cloud.
Right.
Okay, so normally I think, you know, if a business has a trade secret, they would, if they're smart and they want to be really careful, they're going to just keep it in-house and protect it in-house. One of the things that's recognized in trade secret law is that, you know, in order for trade secrets to have value, it has to be used. So there's a concept in trade secret law called relative secrecy. You don't have to keep information you want to keep secret, absolutely secret. You can share it with other people. Now, generally speaking, when you share it with other people, in order for it to be protectable, the other person has to be under a duty of confidentiality in order for the information to be protected. If you're sharing your information with an employee, that's easy to show because there's case law that establishes that employees owe a fiduciary duty to their employers. And so the law will generally impose a kind of a trust relationship on the employees. That is not the same situation when you take that information and give it to someone outside of that relationship. And in that situation, what you need, you then need to, you still need a duty of confidentiality, but how it will arise will be different than in the employer-employee situation.
So given that, while the internet obviously is relatively new, but certainly has been around now, at least the modern commercial internet, depending on how you time it, for at least 15 years, perhaps longer, the issue of storage of information in the cloud has also come up, obviously. There's terabytes and terabytes of information, going into the tens and hundreds of thousands that are stored in the cloud, to use that term. However, trade secrecy, or the issues related to storing a trade secret, given the requirements to maintain it, seems like a relatively new issue. I'm curious, has this issue of storage of a trade secret in the cloud and then some kind of misappropriation related to it been litigated? Is that something that the courts have had to grapple with yet?
Well, this is why I'm so excited about this issue and the article I'm working on, because we see often, and I know on your programs you've delved into these issues. You know, we have a body of law, and I think the IP laws, and particularly trade secrets, is fairly static, but we have new factual situations that arise to which we apply it. There's been examples in cyberspace or cyber law where when we apply old law to new situations, we really kind of, in a way, ruin the law, or we change it in ways that we shouldn't have changed it. Obviously, we're trying to solve a problem that's unique to cyberspace, but what we don't always appreciate, or what the judges don't always appreciate, is when you modify established a set of laws in order to fix, something happening in cyberspace, it's going to have an impact on the law's application generally. And so an obvious example of that is mutual assent, the concepts of mutual assent in contract law. You know, in my opinion, the courts have bent over backwards to make it really easy to form an internet, based contract in order to facilitate the growth of the internet. But in so doing, they, it changes how people perceive entering into contracts in non-internet contexts. The thing that's exciting about this project is that there are a lot of issues in trade secrecy that have not been dealt with a lot in-depthly by the courts. And I think this is an opportunity to look at at trade secret law generally through this very narrow lens, and hopefully come out at the end with a richer body of law. And the one issue in particular that I think needs to be examined is the reasonable efforts requirement. Courts always look at it, and they know it's a requirement, and they always give lip service to it. But in the 30 plus years that the UTSA has been around, they really haven't developed any, what I would consider any helpful standards or guidelines for how to apply it. And that's what's starting to emerge in the scholarship.
We're chatting with Professor Sharon Sandeen of Hamline University School of Law on KZSU-FM Stanford's Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I do hope you continue listening to the station and to Hearsay Culture. So Sharon, let's now discuss cloud storage services in a bit more detail. What generally is offered to businesses with regard to storage in the cloud, and what kind of entities are offering these storage services?
Well, you know, this is to answer that question requires, you know, really almost a daily tracking of what's going in on in the business. And the way I've been thinking about it recently is that, you know, it's the evolution of the computer industry, you know, because when it was started, the companies were making their money, you know, way back when, making, you know, selling hardware. That was the way they made their money. And the legal rules and business practices grew up around that. And then, of course, software was invented, and that's how they made their money. And, you know, we're old enough to remember, you know, that, gee, waiting for the next, you know, software update and you know, and the sales that were generated by that and so forth and so on. But, of course, the useful life of software is much greater and longer now. And so, you know, it occurred to me, how do you make money in the computer industry if the technology, if your advancements in technology basically are so successful that nobody needs to buy your product anymore? And the answer is you create a new business model. And the new business model is this is cloud computing, otherwise known as software as a service, where what the big computer companies are offering now is not the hardware of old and the software of old, but kind of an integrated approach to providing a panoply of computer related, you know, technology and services. One chunk of that is storage services. So the idea would be you don't have to spend a lot of money as a business to have your own servers and the IT people to keep them updated. You can rely on, you know, a company that provides that service.
So, you know, by way of a simple analogy, just to be clear, so what you're talking about then are, for example, a web hosting company, for example. So Hearsay Culture is hosted by a company called Dreamhost in California, and they've done a great job. That service also allows me, and I do store my shows on a dedicated server that Dreamhost maintains, and I expect... and we're going to talk about the contractual expectations in a moment, but I generally expect that Dreamhost is going to do what they tell me they're going to do, which is to make sure that my data is available, but that it's password protected and that not everyone can get to it unless I want them to. I mean, are we talking about entities like web hosting companies that operate servers and ISPs, or is this a broader area that goes into companies that are specifically dedicated to storing trade secrets?
I think all of the above, and I think the reason why I say that is because, as you know, because this new business model or new business idea, established companies and entrepreneurs are trying to figure out a way to fit into it, and so I think there's a variety of business of companies and services that are going to be offered, and they're going to evolve. And so, for instance, let me just give you an example. My concern and criticism, particularly looking at some of the big companies, is if you sign up for these services in their terms of service agreements, they say that they disclaim any responsibility for security, and that if you want security of your data, then you're going to have to take that responsibility on yourself and encrypt it and so forth and so on. I think that presents problems from a trade secret point of view, which we can get into. But the more immediate point is that there is an opportunity for companies, and I think there are companies that historically have said, hey, we will store your information remotely on our computer servers, and we will provide you with, you know, X level of security. That's the service that we're providing. I think that's probably been out there for a while. What we've done is put this label on it called cloud computing, and everybody's kind of jockeying for position about what it is they're going to offer and what the level of service is going to be.
We're talking with Sharon Sandine of Hamline University School of Law and KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So it sounds to me like, Sharon, we're talking about something as rudimentary as a company storing a trade secret on Gmail by virtue of having it an attachment to an email, which seems to be a way of, although maybe not a good one, a way to store a trade secret in the cloud to companies whose dedicated purpose is to store your trade secrets. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that could emerge. I mean, offhand, I can't identify any company who's developed that business model. One of the things I'm doing is part of my article, but it's a moving target, is to try to keep up on all the companies that are emerging and all the companies that are coming up with new services and what the level of services are. But yes, theoretically, you could have on one end of the spectrum, you could have a company that says, hey, use our service to download your information, store your information, but we're not going to make any promises. And then another company that says, use our service, and we are going to make promises about the level of security.
And from what you've seen, it's not atypical for companies to disclaim any liability with respect to security in storing information in the cloud.
It's not atypical. Hmm. Now, one of the things I don't know is whether they're conscious of the consequences of it, and I don't want to suggest they're stupid, but I think that a lot of times terms of use agreements are written with cross purposes. So, for instance, you might write a terms of use agreement in order to avoid, you know, copyright liability or liability for defamation, and the language you use is not helpful when you're trying to make a trade secret argument, to just give an example.
Right.
I think that happens frequently, where a terms of use agreement will be written for one purpose and it serves that purpose, but it has consequences in other areas.
Yeah, which gets us now to this intersection. So, if the terms of service disclaim liability for security, then from a contract perspective, so, and you mentioned this, so long as the parties, you know, particularly the recipient of the contract, or that is the you know, the client that wants to use a service, agrees to that, then so be it. It's unclear to me whether trade secrecy should have anything to say about that. But with regard to situations where you don't have such language, what are the security issues? In other words, what do you see? I mean, is it something as simple as literally misappropriation by way of hacking? Or are you concerned about, or perhaps you're concerned about all, but are you concerned about negligence, accidental security breaches? Where do you see, as you think about, you know, where this area of law is going, where do you see the battles occurring? Is something as blatant as hacking, or something more, you know, less onerous, like negligence?
Well, the thing about the hacking reference and even the negligence reference, of course, in my mind is that's the, you know, what the second prong of the trade secret analysis. That's the misappropriation prong. The first prong is there a trade secret? And I think the problem that informers are going to have who store information on the cloud, if they later want to claim all or part of that information is a trade secret, then they're going to have to prove they engaged in reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy. Now, I already mentioned that the general rule in trade secret law, as it's developed so far, and it may change as a result of this new environment, is that when you give information to a third party, it's not a trade secret if you do not have some sort of duty of confidentiality in place. Now, that duty can be either express, which is, if you're smart, you're going to have an express contractual duty, or it can be implied from the circumstances. And I already mentioned that the employer-employee situation is one such circumstance. But here's the rub with cloud computing. If you need a duty of confidentiality when you give information to a third party, and the third party expressly disclaims any duty of confidentiality, I don't think you could then argue that there's an inferred duty of confidentiality. In fact, I think case law involving, you know, just contract law and inferred duties would support that proposition. That, you know, you can't infer duty when it's expressly disclaimed. So that's the problem.
So are you suggesting, you know, we have about 10 minutes left here, and of course, like always on the show, we can't get into all of the issues in great detail, but we can spend a little time. Are you suggesting that trade secret owners simply cannot rely on cloud computing as a reasonable method to maintain a trade secret, or is there a way in the current state of affairs for a trade secret holder to use the cloud effectively?
I don't think. Here's what I would say, and here's my at least my thesis and what I'm working on is I don't think you can rely on an implied duty. So at a minimum, you're going to have to do something else to show that you engaged in reasonable efforts. And I think this is where, you know, encryption and other technological means will come in. You know, and you might argue, yes, I stored my information in the cloud, but I did so in such a way that it was protected. And related to that is the argument that I'm working on that I think is unexplored in trade secret law, which is what constitutes a disclosure. Trade secret law basically makes three things potentially wrong: acquisition, disclosure, and use. And when you give information to a third party, arguably you're disclosing it and thereby losing your trade secret protection. But maybe there's an argument that can be made that it's not actually a disclosure of information. It's just a transfer of information. That the cloud computing company doesn't actually see the information. So it's not disclosed. It's just transferred.
Yeah,
that provides the seeds of an argument.
And I think, I should acknowledge here that this is something you're working on now. And so, you know, towards the end of the show, which isn't that far away, I'll ask you where people can learn more about your work. But to push back for a second on the implied duty, I mean, don't we have cases where the court finds an implied duty of confidentiality by virtue of the nature of the relationship? So we have cases where information is disclosed to third parties for purposes of a merger, and then the party who receives the information goes ahead and uses the information in a way that ultimately has nothing to do with the merger, but rather competes with the entity that shared the information. And the court says there's an implied duty of confidentiality because you knew, receiver of the trade secret, why that information was given to you in the first place. Couldn't we argue that if an entity whose purpose, whose reason for being is to store information, receives a trade secret, that and assuming And I guess maybe that's the key, that the receiver of the trade secret knows that the holder of that information thinks it's a trade secret. Couldn't we say that an implied duty exists there? Or is that just too tenuous a read?
Well, I mean, obviously, a trade secret owner is going to try to make that argument. I think it would be a difficult argument to make, I mean, to prevail on. I think the other thing we have to think about is how the cloud is actually going to be used. I mean, a lot of the advertisements concerning cloud services suggest that, you know, store everything. You know, have your employees access the information from anywhere. You know, have multiple employees work on the information sequentially, you know, and so forth and so on. So there's the possibility that the companies who use these services don't even know that what's being created is a trade secret. You know, maybe it starts as an idea and then it evolves through this process into something that is valuable, but they don't have the processes in place to really identify it. So I think that's part of the problem. In a lot of trade secret cases, are present just those facts, and that's why I mentioned earlier that some companies don't know they have trade secrets until they allege that somebody stole them. And it's because a lot of companies are engaged in business, and frankly, they don't care whether it's a trade secret or not until somebody takes the information and they want to stop them.
Do you get the sense in your research that any of the providers of these cloud storage services are even aware of this issue? In other words, do you see companies making efforts to either specifically deal with the trade secret issue and say we're safe or not? I mean, in other words, is this on the radar screen at all of the providers themselves, putting aside the fact that you haven't come across any businesses that actually market themselves this way?
I know they're aware of it and they're trying to address it with regard to privacy requirements. I think they've made the leap to address it with regard to trade secrecy, although I think there's a lot of analogies to be drawn. And what you need to consider is how the issues arise, right? The privacy issues are kind of an affirmative duty being placed on companies. You know, thou shall protect X privacy, X information, because it's deserving of privacy. Whereas trade secret is more of a situation where it's in the company's interest to act. So they don't really have a duty to protect it imposed on them by the government, but they have an interest in protecting it. It remains to be seen if the companies that are touting the, you know, their services for privacy purposes will make the, you know, leap to the trade secret issue.
So we're chatting with Sharon Sandeen, professor of law at Hamline University School of Law. Sharon, we have about 5 minutes left, and so I'll ask you these more forward-looking questions. For entities that despite your concerns, are interested in using the cloud to store trade secrets, what suggestions do you have for those companies in terms of what should they check on? What should they be sure about? Do you have a sense of what best practices might be for companies using the cloud on a going forward basis?
Well, I think my general advice would be applicable to people who use the cloud and people who don't. And my general advice is don't over-assert trade secrets. I don't want to suggest they're not valuable and everything, but the reality of the situation is, you know, trade secret protection is weak on purpose, as I said earlier. And so I think the most important thing a company can do is to really take the time to identify those kernels of information that are really important and protect them. So you do protect the formula for Coca-Cola, but maybe you don't have to protect the list of distributors for Coca-Cola. So there is information within ad companies that may rise to that level, but not all information rises to that level. And so I think that's the strategy I would recommend.
And similarly, what would you like to see storage services doing to make this issue not only easier for the courts to deal with, but ultimately easier for businesses to operate?
Well, it really depends on, you know, the business model they choose. I guess what I would say is be upfront with your customers about the business model you've chosen. If the business model is, you know, we're not going to protect anything, the security of anything, or we don't guarantee it, or we're not going to add any bells and whistles to enhance security over the general level, then say that. And then that provides a business opportunity for those companies that want to provide it to market that. Of course, those companies presumably would be entitled to higher prices because they're providing a higher level of service.
We are chatting with Professor Sharon Sandeen, Hamline University School of Law. Sharon, for those that want to learn more about your work, where can they go?
Well, my website at Hamline University, or my webpage at Hamline University, has links to a lot of my articles. That's hamline.edu, that's spelled H-A-M-L-I-N-E. And then I also have a page on SSRN.
Sharon, I recognize that this is a work in progress. I won't put you on a spot and say, when can we see the final article? But I certainly, and I think listeners look forward to seeing the final fruits of your labor here, because I think this is a very interesting issue that touches ultimately on what we do with technology in 2010, and how businesses can realistically and not so realistically use a technology based upon the business practices that exist. So thank you much for joining us today on the show. I certainly invite you back to continue this discussion, but I appreciate you taking the time and informing the audience with respect to these questions.
Thank you very much. It was fun to be on.
I'm very excited to mention a number of upcoming guests on Hearsay Culture, people that I think will be very, very exciting, and I think a wide range of guests coming on this quarter. Coming up next week is Associate Dean Mike Madison of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, discussing his work, focusing primarily on cultural issues and the sharing of knowledge. The following week, we'll be having on Professor Fred Stutzman, Fred Stutzman, who's a doctoral candidate at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who's written the interesting app Freedom, and writes about social networking and its impact on culture generally. Professor Peter Lee of UC Davis School of Law, beyond discussing technology transfer and innovation. Professor Greg Listowka of Rutgers University School of Law will be on discussing his forthcoming book on virtual worlds and regulation. Professor Tim Wu of Columbia Law School will be on discussing his upcoming work, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Professor Nick Bostrom, who's the director of the Future of Humanity Institute and a professor at the University of Oxford, will be on. Professor Adrian Johns of the University of Chicago, author of a lengthy and really, I think, definitive work on piracy, called appropriately Piracy. Ryan Kahlo, the director of the Consumer Privacy Project at Stanford's Center for Internet Society, will be on discussing his work. And rounding out this quarter will be Sarah Rose, author of the book For All the Tea in China. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can pick up the show by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu if you want to stream the show, or listening live in the Bay Area from 5 to 6 p.m. on Wednesdays. You can also pick up the show by podcast, either by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get the schedule as well as a list of all the previous guests and what's coming up down the road. You can pick up the show by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, where you can subscribe there. And lastly, you can go to Stanford CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu and pick the show up by RSS feed. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So I do want to, by the way, as an aside, thank Joe Nito of the AV department at Stanford Law School, who is the person responsible for placing the show up on the web, and I greatly appreciate his hard work and efforts doing this. As well, at the beginning of the quarter, I like to also thank all of my friends at KZSU, particularly not only a program director and chief engineer, but the DJs that make sure that the show goes on the air when it's supposed to. Your help is deeply appreciated, and I thank you for it. So thanks for listening to the show today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.